Okay, I just want to thank the commission for inviting me to talk about this topic and all of you for being here to listen to me. So I'm going to deal mainly with the near and medium-term future, but I want to start my presentation in the past. So, you know, in the mid-19th century, a set of laws were created to address the menace that the newly invented automobile posed to road users. One of the first such laws was the English Locomotive Act of 1865, which subsequently became known as the Red Flag Act. So under this act, any user of a self-propelled vehicle had to ensure that at least two people were employed to manage the vehicle, and that one of these persons, while any such locomotive is in motion, shall precede such locomotive on foot by not less than 60 yards, and shall carry a red flag constantly displayed, and shall warn the riders and drivers of horses of the approach of such locomotives. So, you know, the motive behind this was commendable. Automobiles did pose a new threat to other more vulnerable road users, but I think to modern eyes, this law is ridiculous. To suggest that every car should be preceded by a pedestrian on foot would seem to defeat the point of having a car. All right? The whole idea is that it is faster and more efficient than walking. And the ridiculous nature of the law eventually became apparent to its creators, and all such laws were repealed in the 1890s, approximately 30 years after their introduction. So the story of the red flag laws shows how legal systems can often get new and emerging technologies badly wrong. By focusing on the obvious or immediate risks, the law can neglect the long-term benefits and costs. So I mention all this by way of a warning. You know, as I understand it, it has been about 20 years since the Law Reform Commission last considered issues around privacy and surveillance, and a lot has happened in the intervening decades. And my goal in this talk is to give some sense of where we are now and what the future challenges may be. But in doing this, I hope not to forget the lesson of the red flag laws. All right, so let me just start with what I think is the most obvious question here, which is what has changed, technologically speaking, since the Law Reform Commission last considered this topic? And I think two things would stand out. First, we've very clearly entered the era of mass surveillance. The proliferation of digital devices, like laptops, computers, tablets, smartphones, smartwatches, smart cars, smart fridges, smart thermostats, and so on, combined with increased internet connectivity, has resulted in a world in which we are all monitored and recorded every minute of every day of our lives. The cheapness and ubiquity of data collecting devices means that it is now possible, in principle, to imbue every object, animal, and person with some kind of data monitoring technology. And the result of this would be the creation of what some people refer to as the Internet of Everything. So not just the Internet of Things, but of everything. And with it will come the possibility of essentially a perfect digital panopticon. So this clearly puts a lot of pressure on the concept of privacy and the value of privacy, and at least within the EU, this has prompted a significant legislative intervention in the form of the GDPR. The second thing that's changed is that we've created technologies that can take advantage of all the data that is now being collected. Right? To state the obvious, data by itself is never enough. As all lawyers know, it's easy to befuddle the opposition in a complex lawsuit by dumping a lot of data on them during discovery process, and they drown in the resultant sea of information. It's what we can do with the data that really matters, and in this respect, I think it's the marriage of mass surveillance with new kinds of artificial intelligence that creates the new legal challenges that we have to tackle now with some urgency. So, I think artificial intelligence enables us to do three important things with the vast quantities of data that are now being collected. So first, it enables new kinds of pattern spotting. So what I mean here is that AI systems can spot patterns in data that were historically difficult for computer systems to spot, things like image and voice recognition and natural language processing, and that may be also difficult, if not impossible, for humans to spot due to their complexity. So to put this another way, AI allows us to understand data in new ways. The second thing it does is that it enables the creation of new kinds of informational product. So what I mean here is that the information created by AI systems are not dispassionate and objective forms of the data that we collect. AI actively constructs and reshapes the data into artifacts that can be more or less useful to human beings. And the third thing that this does is that it enables new kinds of action and behavior. Right? So the informational products created by AI are not simply inert artifacts that we just observe with some kind of bemused detachment. They are prompts to new kinds of behavior and new kinds of decision-making. Right? Now, on top of all this, the AI systems do these three things with increasing levels of autonomy, or maybe to put it less controversially, increasing levels of automation. Right? So although humans do assist AI in collecting and understanding data, constructing and acting on data, it is increasingly possible for AI to do things without direct human assistance or intervention. So it is these three ways of using data, coupled with increasing automation, that I believe gives rise to the new legal challenges. Now, it's going to be impossible for me to discuss all of these in this talk, so what I will do instead is to discuss three case studies that I think are indicative of the kinds of challenges that will need to be addressed in the coming years, and each of these correspond to the three things that we can do with data. Okay, so the first case study has to do with facial recognition technology. This is an excellent example of how AI can understand data in new ways. Facial recognition technology is essentially like a fingerprint of your face. So from a selection of images, an algorithm can construct a mathematical model of your key facial features, and then can track and trace your identity across numerous locations. Now look, the potential conveniences and advantages of this technology are considerable. We can have faster security clearance at airports. It's a convenient way to record and confirm attendance at schools. It's an end to complex passwords when accessing digital services. It's a way for security services to track and identify criminals. It's a tool for locating missing persons and finding old friends. So little surprise, then, that many of us have already welcomed this technology into our lives. It's the default setting on the current generation of smartphones for security purposes. And it's also being trialed at airports, including Dublin Airport, train stations, and public squares around the world. It's cheap. You can easily plug it into existing CCTV systems. And it can also take advantage of the vast databases of facial images that are already collected by governments and by social media engines. Now, despite its advantages, facial recognition technology also poses a significant number of risks. It enables and normalizes blanket surveillance of individuals across numerous environments, and this makes it the perfect tool for oppressive governments and manipulative corporations. So our faces are one of our most unique and important features, you know, central to our identity and to how we relate to other people. And think here of, you know, the Beatles and their immortal line about Eleanor Rigby putting on the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. So what facial recognition does is it captures this unique feature of us and turns it into a digital product that can be copied and traded and then used for marketing, intimidation, and harassment. So consider here as an example the unintended consequences of the Find Face app that was released in Russia in 2016. So this was intended by its creators to be a way of making new friends. What the Find Face app did is it matched images on your phone with images in social media databases. So suppose you met somebody at a party, took a picture with them, but didn't get their name. But the Find Face app would allow you to trace their identity by matching the image on your phone with something in a social media database. Right, so what a wonderful idea, right? You know, now you can never need to miss out on an opportunity for friendship due to bad memory or oversight. Well, as you might imagine, this app also has a dark side. Right? It turns out to be a perfect tool for stalkers, harassers, and doxers. It's the internet slang for people who want to out people's real-world identities. So anyone who's trying to hide or obscure their identity can now be traced and tracked by anyone who happens to take a photograph of them. What's more, facial recognition technology is not perfect. It has been shown to be less reliable when dealing with non-white faces. And there are several documented cases in which it matches the wrong faces and thus wrongly assumes that somebody is a criminal when they aren't. For example, many drivers in the US have had their licenses automatically cancelled when an algorithm found two faces on a driver license database to be suspiciously similar and assumed that the people in question were using a false identity. In another, perhaps more dramatic illustration of the problem, last year, 28 members of the US Congress, several of them members of racial minorities, were falsely matched with criminal mugshots using a facial recognition technology created by Amazon that's being used by a number of, or was used by a number of law enforcement agencies across the U.S. Right? As some researchers have put it, the widespread and indiscriminate use of facial recognition technology means that we are all now part of a perpetual suspect lineup, one that is both biased and error-prone. So the conveniences of facial recognition come at a price that often only becomes apparent when something goes wrong, and that is more costly for some social groups than for others. So what should be done about this from a legal perspective? Well, you know, the obvious answer is that you try to regulate the technology to manage its risks and opportunities. And this is, in a sense, what's already being done under the GDPR. So Article 9 of the GDPR stipulates that facial recognition is a kind of biometric data that is subject to special protections. Right? The default position is that you shouldn't really collect it, but this is then subject to a long list of qualifications and exceptions. So, for example, it's permissible to collect the data if it has already been made public, if you get the explicit consent of the person, if it serves some legitimate public interest, if it is medically necessary or necessary for public health reasons, or if it is necessary to protect other rights. So, I mean, the GDPR does restrict some uses of facial recognition. There was a recent Swedish case in which a school was fined for using facial recognition technology for attendance monitoring. Nevertheless, the long list of exceptions and qualifications makes the widespread use of facial recognition not just a possibility, but a likelihood. And this is something that the EU is aware of, and actually in light of the Swedish case, they have signaled an intention to have more restrictive regulations of the technology. So, I mean, this is something that I think we in Ireland should also be considering. So, you know, the GDPR allows states to introduce stricter protections against certain kinds of data collection. And according to some privacy scholars, we need the strictest possible protections to save us from the depredations of facial recognition. So Woodrow Hartzog, who's one of the leading privacy scholars in the US, and Evan Selinger, who's a philosopher of technology, have recently issued a joint call for a ban of facial recognition. And as they put it, somewhat alarmingly, the future of human flourishing depends on facial recognition technology being banned before the systems become too entrenched in our lives. Otherwise, people won't know what it's like to be in public without being automatically identified, profiled, and potentially exploited. They also caution against anyone who thinks that we can just regulate the technology to some kind of optimal state, arguing that governmental and commercial interests will always push for expanded uses of the technology beyond any initially prescribed remit. They argue that attempts at informed consent here will be, and indeed are already proven to be, a spectacular failure because people don't understand what they are consenting to when they give away their facial fingerprint. Now, some people might find this call for a categorical ban extreme, unnecessary, impractical even. But I would like to suggest that there is something worth taking seriously here, particularly since facial recognition technology is just the tip of the iceberg of data collection. People are already experimenting with emotion recognition technology, which tries to use facial images to predict future behavior in real time. And there are many other kinds of sensitive data that are now being collected, digitized, and traded, genetic data being perhaps the most obvious other example. So given that data is what fuels the fire of AI, and AI can be misused, it's possible that we should consider cutting off some of the fuel supply in its entirety. Let me move on then to my second case study. This one has to do with how AI can be used to create new kinds of informational product from data. And my example here is deepfake technology. So this is a machine learning technique that allows you to construct realistic synthetic media from databases of images and audio files. Now, the most prevalent use of deepfakes is, perhaps predictably, in the world of pornography, where the faces of famous actors have been repeatedly grafted onto porn videos. And this is disturbing, and it also makes deepfakes an ideal technology for what might be called, you know, synthetic revenge porn. But perhaps more socially significant than this are the potential political uses of deepfake technology. So in 2017, a team of researchers at the University of Washington attracted a lot of notoriety because they created a series of deepfake videos of Barack Obama, which I'll now try to play for you. So what the image on the right there is a synthetically constructed image. And what they're doing is they're taking the audio from a previous video clip and they're syncing it to this synthetically constructed image. And the big breakthrough here was that they created a way to manipulate Obama's lips to make it look like he was saying anything that they could play over it. Okay? So they used previous audio clips of him to sync to the synthetic video. But you can also use audio clips of people impersonating him. And there are also researchers that are experimenting with creating entirely synthetic audio files as well. Okay. Now, you know, if you look at this video, it's not entirely convincing. There's something stilted and artificial about it. But as the technology improves, it's likely that even the most discerning viewers of this will find it very difficult to tell the difference between the fiction and the reality. Now, look, you know, there's nothing new about synthetic media in and of itself. With the support of the New Zealand Law Foundation, Tom Barraclough and Curtis Barnes have recently published a very detailed investigation into the legal policy implications of deepfake technology. And in their report, they highlight that an awful lot of existing media is synthetic. It's all processed, manipulated, and edited to some degree. There's also, you know, a long history of people creating synthetic representations of political and public figures. You think of the caricatures in Punch magazine or Spitting Image or something like that. All right? And many people who use deepfake technology will probably claim a legitimate purpose in doing so. They'll say that they're engaging in legitimate satire or critique, or that they're producing works of artistic significance. Nevertheless, there does seem to be something pretty worrying about deepfake technology. The highly realistic nature of the audiovisual material that's created, again, makes this the ideal vehicle for harassment, manipulation, forgery, and fraud. Furthermore, you know, the realism of the resultant material poses a significant epistemic challenge for society. So the philosopher Regina Rini, I think, captures this problem pretty well when she argues that deepfake technology poses a threat to society's epistemic backstop. So what she means by this is that as a society, we are highly reliant on the testimony from others to get by. We use it for news and information, we use it to form expectations, develop trust in other people. Now, we all know that testimony is not always reliable. Again, this is something that lawyers will be intimately familiar with. Sometimes people lie to us, sometimes they'll forget or distort what really happened. And audiovisual recordings provide an important check on potentially misleading forms of testimony. They encourage honesty and competence. So as Rini puts it, our awareness of the possibility of being recorded provides a quasi-independent check on any reckless testifying we might do, thereby strengthening the reasonability of relying on the words of others. Recordings do this in two distinctive ways. They actively correct errors in past testimony, and then they passively regulate ongoing testimonial practices. And just as an illustration of this, one of the examples she uses is of Richard Nixon being caught out by recordings of what he said in the White House. But also, there are lots of racial minorities who use videos to record instances of racist abuse. Okay, and that's a way of kind of turning surveillance technology back on the people who might use it for controlling purposes. The problem with deepfake technology is that it undermines this function. Right? Audiovisual recordings can no longer provide the epistemic backstop that keeps us all honest. So what does this mean for the law? Well, look, I'm not overly concerned about the impact of deepfake technology on legal evidence gathering processes. I think the legal system, with its insistence on chain of custody and testimonial verification of audiovisual materials, is probably better placed than most systems to deal with the threat of deepfakes. Though I think there will be an increased need for forensic experts to testify in court to identify deepfake recordings. What I'm more concerned about is how deepfake technologies will be weaponized to harm and intimidate others, particularly members of vulnerable populations. And the question is whether anything can be done to provide legal redress for this problem. So as Barraclough and Barnes point out in their report, it's pretty difficult to legislate in this area. You know, how do you define the difference between real and synthetic media? How do you balance the free speech rights against the potential harms to others? Do we need specialized laws to deal with these problems? Or can existing laws on, say, you know, defamation or fraud be up to the task? Furthermore, given that deepfakes can be created and distributed by unknown actors, who would any potential cause of redress be against? Now, these are difficult questions to answer. One concrete suggestion I might have is that any existing or proposed legislation on revenge porn, or more euphemistically, the non-consensual sharing of intimate images, should be modified to uncover the possibility of synthetic revenge porn. So I just noted that Ireland is currently legislating in this area, and the current wording of the offence in the bill covers images that have been altered. But, you know, somebody might argue that synthetically constructed images are not, strictly speaking, altered. They are constructed and artificial. Right, so there may be plans to change this wording. I know that there are consultations and amendments that are going to be ongoing on this bill, but if there aren't, then I would suggest that there should be. And to reiterate, I'm just using deepfake technology as an illustration of a more general problem. There are many other ways in which the combination of data and artificial intelligence can mess with the distinction between fact and fiction. The algorithmic curation and promotion of fake news, or the use of virtual and augmented reality to change how we perceive public and private spaces, they all pose significant threats to property rights, privacy rights, and political rights. Well, let me turn then to my final case study. And this one has to do with the world of algorithmic risk prediction. Right, so this is where we take... This is an example of how AI can prompt new kinds of behavior and decision-making. And this is where we take data points concerning an individual's behavior and lifestyle, we feed it into an algorithm, and we use this to make predictions about their likely future behavior. Now, this is a long-standing practice in insurance, and it's now being used in making credit decisions, in tax auditing, in child protection, and in the criminal justice system. These are just a few examples as well. So I'll focus on its use in criminal justice for illustrative purposes. And specifically, I'm going to focus on a debate surrounding something called the COMPASS algorithm, which is used in a number of US states. So the COMPASS algorithm uses data points to generate a recidivism risk score for criminal defendants. Now, the data points here include things like the person's age at arrest, their prior arrest and conviction record, the number of family members and friends that, or associates, sorry, that have been arrested and convicted, their address, their education, their job, and so on. These data points are then weighted together using an algorithm to generate a risk score. Now, the exact weighting procedure is unclear since the COMPASS algorithm is a proprietary technology, but the company has released a considerable amount of information about the data it uses to generate its scores. Now, if you know anything about the COMPASS algorithm, you'll know that it's been controversial, and this controversy stems from two features of how it works. First, it's relatively opaque in its operation. And this is a problem because the fair administration of justice requires that legal decision-making be transparent and open to challenge. Right, so actually, a defendant in the US in a case called Loomis versus Wisconsin challenged the use of a COMPASS algorithm in his sentencing decision on the basis of its opacity, that he couldn't challenge the logic involved. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled against him and said that the trial court in question had not relied solely on this COMPASS algorithm in reaching their sentencing decision. The risk score was just one input into their decision-making process, and that decision-making process as a whole was transparent and open to challenge. But the court did agree that we should be very wary about relying on these risk scores in reaching decisions, and that the risk score should come with a set of warnings attached to it to make sure that people don't over-rely on it. Now, the second controversy associated with the COMPASS algorithm has to do with its apparent racial bias. And to understand this controversy, I'm going to say a little bit more about how the algorithm works. What the COMPASS algorithm does is that it sorts defendants into two buckets. And buckets is the language that data scientists use to describe this. And there's a high risk of reoffense bucket, and there is a low risk of reoffense bucket. Okay? And then there are whatever happens in the real world afterwards. Either the prediction was wrong or it was right. So it was either a false positive or a true positive or a false negative or a true negative. Now, a group of data journalists at an online magazine called ProPublica conducted an investigation into this a couple of years ago, and they tried to figure out what kinds of defendants get sorted into the different buckets. And they found something disturbing. They found that the COMPASS algorithm is more likely to give black defendants a false positive high-risk score and more likely to give white defendants a false negative low-risk score. Right? So, I mean, to put this another way, the COMPASS algorithm tended to rate black defendants as being a higher risk of reoffense than they actually were, and white defendants as being a lower risk of reoffense than they actually were. Right? Now, needless to say, the makers of the COMPASS algorithm weren't happy about this finding. They didn't use race as an explicit criterion in their algorithm at all. And they defended their algorithm, arguing that it was, in fact, fair and non-discriminatory because it was well-calibrated. So in other words, they argued that it was equally accurate in scoring defendants irrespective of their race. So if it said that a black defendant was at a high risk of reoffending, it was right about 60% of the time. And if it said that a white defendant was at a high risk of reoffending, it was right about 60% of the time. Okay, and this turns out to be true if you look at these figures, but if you compare the did reoffend in high risk score relative to the total number of high risk for both classes of defendant. It turns out it's roughly 60% for both of them. Okay. So what's going on here? Is the algorithm fair or not? So here's where things get interesting. Several groups of mathematicians have analyzed this case, and they've shown that the main problem here is that the makers of the Compass algorithm and the data journalists who critiqued them were working with different conceptions of fairness, and that these conceptions of fairness are fundamentally incompatible. And this is actually something that can be formally proved, and the clearest articulation of this proof can be found in a paper by John Kleinberg, Sendhil Mullanathan, and Manish Raghavan. So to simplify their argument, they say that there's two things you might want a fair decision algorithm to do. You might want it to be well calibrated, that means equally accurate, irrespective of the racial group of the defendant. Or you might want it to achieve an equal representation for all groups in the outcome buckets. Right, so that you get the same number of false positives and false negatives for both groups. And what they proved is that except in two unusual cases, it's going to be impossible to satisfy both criteria at the same time. Now, the two unusual cases are where the algorithm is a perfect predictor. In other words, it just always gets things right. And the other case is where the base rates for the relevant populations are the same. In other words, it's the same number of black defendants as there are white defendants. Now, since no algorithmic decision procedure is a perfect predictor, and since the criminal justice system is full of base rate inequalities when it comes to both classes of defendant, this means that there's going to be no plausible real-world use of a predictive algorithm like this. It's going to satisfy both criteria of fairness. And what's more, this is true for all algorithmic risk prediction, not just cases involving recidivism. And if you want to see like a really intuitive illustration of this, there's an excellent article that was published in the MIT Technology Review that includes a game that you can play using the Compass algorithm that shows you the trade-off between the different conceptions of fairness and how it's impossible to satisfy both at the same time. So what does all this mean for the law? Well, when it comes to the issue of the transparency and challengeability of these algorithms, it's worth noting that the GDPR in Articles 13 to 15 and Article 22 contains what some people refer to as a right to explanation, which means that people have a right to access meaningful information about the logic of automated decision procedures. Now, what that meaningful information looks like in practice is going to be open to some interpretation, but there is now an increasing amount of guidance on this from national data protection authorities. But what I want to argue is that in some ways this misses the deeper point, which is that even if we make these procedures perfectly transparent and explainable, there remains the question about how we manage the hard trade-off between the different conceptions of fairness and non-discrimination. So look, our legal concept of fairness is multidimensional and requires us to balance competing interests. When we rely on human decision-makers to determine what's fair, we accept that there's always going to be some fudging and compromise involved. And right now, we let this fudging take place in the minds of human decision makers, oftentimes without questioning it too much or making it too explicit. And this includes even when we reduce reasoning to writing. The problem with algorithmic risk predictions is that they force us to make the fudging explicit and precise. We can no longer pretend that decisions have successfully balanced all the competing interests and demands. We have to pick and choose. Thus, in some ways, the real challenge here is not that the systems are opaque and non-transparent, but that when they are transparent, they're going to force us to make hard choices. Now, to some, this is the great advantage of algorithmic risk prediction. Another paper by John Kleinberg and his colleagues called Discrimination in the Age of the Algorithm makes this case. They argue that the real problem with decision-making at the moment is that it is discriminatory, but the discriminatory nature of it is implicit and hidden from view. The widespread use of transparent algorithms, they argue, will force this into the open, where it can be washed with the great disinfectant of sunlight. But I suspect others will be less sanguine about this brave new world of algorithmically mediated justice. They will argue that human-led decision-making, with its implicit fudging, is preferable, partly because it allows us to sustain the illusion of justice. So which world do we want to live in? The transparent and explicit world imagined by Kleinberg et al., or the murky or more implicit world of human decision-making? This is also, I think, a key legal challenge for the modern age. Right, look, I'm going to wrap up now, and just one last question you might have about the challenges I've outlined is whether they are genuinely new. And look, in one sense, there's nothing completely new about the challenges I've just discussed. We've been dealing with variations of them for as long as we've had complex literate societies. But there are a couple of differences with the past. There are differences of scope and scale. Mass surveillance in AI enables the collection of data at an unprecedented scale and enables it to be used on millions of people at the same time. There are differences of speed and individuation. AI systems can update their operating parameters in real time and in highly individualized ways. And finally, there are the crucial differences of the degree of autonomy with which these systems operate, which can lead to problems in how we assign legal responsibility and blame. And I think that's actually something that Moya will probably take up in her discussion. So thank you.